Hi, and welcome to the Movies You Love podcast, the podcast where I generally get to sit down and talk to a lot of interesting people about the film that they fell in love with. And this is, I think, obvious. I don't know why I'm saying this as a fact, but the first regular episode of the new year of 2014. And with it being a new year, I said, what the hell, why not do something a little bit different? Why not do something a little bit more curious? Why not do something a little bit more than what I've been already doing? And the show, it follows the regular format, it does all the things it wants to, everything you enjoy is back, and we're away from the end of year show that we just did. I hope you guys liked that, I really enjoyed it. But this episode, I decided to throw in a little twist, a little personal twist, because I find that with all the episodes that I've released so far, that I've done so far, while I'm sure part of me is in there, it's more about the others. And I won't say this is any different in that sense, but also I'm sure a lot of people out there are going to get a lot more hints about myself, as well as my guest, who I happens to be my father. I decided to invite my father, Gordon Robinson, otherwise known, as I mentioned in the show, the Terrible Tout, on to talk about the film. And he decided to talk about the 60s classic, It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. Did I enter an extra mad into the title? You're just going to have to tell me later, because I don't even know and I'm not re-recording this. But yeah, this is kind of a fantastic conversation that I had with my dad around the turn of the year. And, like, I thought it'd be an interesting experiment, and it turned out kind of good. I hope you guys enjoy it. I don't think I have anything else to introduce in this bit here. But guys, 60s comedies are big. So enjoy.
A United Airlines jet lands in Los Angeles, launching the biggest entertainment airlift in motion picture history. The world's press, some 300 newsmen from four continents, arrive for the Hollywood premiere of Stanley Kramer's
It's a Mad, 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 Mad World.
There was a certain amount of money buried down in this park. Now, I suggest that we quietly get into our cars, and then when we get down there, we dig up the money, providing that there is some money there.
There's only one way to figure it, and that is every man for himself.
I think it's kind of weird to not call this somewhat special and interesting kind of conversation that I'm going to be having in this version, because unlike all of my other episodes, I tend to focus on people who, I'm not going to say any different from you, but, like, want to have a desired interest in film. Like, a specific, focused, have to be completely into it. You're, like, fun. You, like, enjoy fun movies. And today I have on my father, Gordon Robinson, otherwise discussed and known as the Terrible Tout within certain circles. Is it wrong to out you? Am I supposed to keep that hidden?
No. It won't be long before they learn that I am a very terrible tout. How are you, Grandmaster Andrew Neil?
Oh, don't tell them where the GM came from.
So I've outed you then.
I remember when one person asked me that, like, years later. Uh-huh. Like, where did G-Man Reviews came from? It was Matthew Price over in Toronto a year ago. And, like, every person who I talked to afterwards who heard that episode was like, why is it it never came to mind to ask where G-Man came from?
Well, since I've been through the chess experience with you, I couldn't help. You know, people, as you say, people look at it as G-Man, and I look at it as GM.
Mm-hmm. Because weird. You know where it comes from.
Yeah. weird.
Yeah, so the movie you selected this time around to look at is the 1963 Stanley Kramer classic, It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. And can I tell you how many times I've thought of this movie and always mixed up the number of mads that are in the title?
Yeah, it is a fantastic movie. I picked that movie, you know, Andrew, because it's the first time I ever went to the movies and realized that you can be a huge star and do a bit part. when you saw the list of stars in that movie,
mm-hmm.
of course, 25 years later, we grow accustomed to what we now call ensemble casts.
Yeah.
Yeah. But in those days, I want to assure you, for somebody like, I don't know, like Jim Backus,
mm-hmm.
to not even enter the movie in the first hour, you know, was unheard of. And it really struck me that this could be an art and not just something you go to for a story. And of course, I don't have to tell you how hilarious that movie is. It's unbelievable.
This movie was originally released in the US in 1963. If I'm doing my math correctly, that makes the movie 1 year older than you. Am I doing my math correctly?
1963?
Yes.
You mean 100 years older than me? No, 1963. No. In 1963, I was all of 9 years old.
9 years old.
Now you're thinking of 64.
Okay.
Which, I wish I was born in 64, but no. I was 9 years old. But you must remember, here's another thing you must remember. Look, folks, I don't know how old your audience is. But
they're all 20.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Born after all the sense the Lord had to send out.
I will tell you, you are the oldest person
ever
to have come on here. But I'm going to tell you, I'm pretty sure it's not by as much as you think.
Okay, then. In 1963, are you sitting down, folks? This is going to shock and amaze you. There was no internet. No, when you live in a small country like Jamaica, in 1963... when something is released in the USA in 1963, you don't even hear about it until 1964.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't actually get here to be shown in theaters until 1965.
Okay.
When it becomes what we call new for you.
Yeah.
You know, but it's been... So I suspect I was 10 or 11,
mm-hmm.
Going in the vague recesses of my mind when I first saw this movie. But it has it has left an indelible impression on me.
So you're saying you saw it for the first time somewhere around 64, 65, not
right.
quite sure.
Right.
Can you tell me what you can remember about that experience of going at that time in your life?
Okay, in those days we had a thing called the drive-in movie. And this is how it was done. There was mom and dad up front in the car, the two children, because there was two at that time, in the back in pajamas,
mm-hmm.
because this was like a sleepover outing, pajamas with your pillow and your blankets, and you're in the back of the car, and you're heading out now, trip of about, oh gosh, you have to help with the distances, 5 miles.
We're going to Old Harbor.
Harbor View
driving around that.
It feels about
like 20 minutes-ish.
It's about 20 minutes. But trust me when I tell you, at age 10, it's forever.
Yeah.
You're going into a different country,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then you. It's called a drive-in movie because you never leave your car. I don't think we have drive-in cinemas anymore.
Like, wherever they still exist, because I know they still exist. I know people who talk about going to it even today. It's very niche and very, very... as people of my sensibilities would say, very low tech, because people can't really keep up with the technological things that people want in their cinemas today.
It just goes to show you how things evolve with time. It was at the time the most exciting thing you could think about, because remember, first off, it's something the family did together.
Mm-hmm.
That was key. Second off, it involved a drive.
Mm-hmm.
Look. I know that today you have spaceships that hover above the ground and things like that. We had old-fashioned things. You never see them anymore, called motor cars. No, none of them had air conditioning either. So you would get in the back of the car and you would drive. And this is not a bumper-to-bumper traffic type of driving. This is a driving out onto the open road with the wind blowing in your hair. Oh, good grief, man. You felt like Sinbad the Sailor. And by the time you reached the movie, you were fast asleep.
Yeah.
You know, so your father paid and you drove in and he woke you up. And then what you would do is you would drive up to a post, that's the best thing I can describe it. And on that post is a what would you call it? It's not a microphone.
It's a radio output. It's a speaker.
Right, a speaker. That's the word I was searching for. It's a speaker. It's a speaker that could be detached. You parked up beside the pole. You detached the speaker, hooked it onto your car, open car window, and there was your audio.
So question, because I remember going to the drive-in as a child. It used to take me very much in the same kind of story you just told.
Right.
Where, you know, mommy and daddy are in the front seat. Mm-hmm. Douglas and I are in the back. We have the pajamas on. Yeah. And we're not really caring that there's a movie on and we're either jumping around or whatever. But I remember specifically, and I even told this story to someone recently, about this one time. I think it was when we went to the Flintstones. I remember going to that movie at the drive-in. And I think it might have been the first time I realized technology when it comes to movies, which is that I had asked you, because what we did at that time is it would actually come through our radio.
Right.
Right? You would turn on the tuner.
Oh, that was real high tech.
So that wasn't... People weren't doing it
then? No, come on. Very few people had radios in their car. That's the first thing.
I don't know. That just seemed... Like, because maybe it's because I'm young and I know cars as they are today.
No, radios
seem like a standard thing.
That came in when we had the brand new drive-in built in New Kingston, which was really sad because it was in town and it was not... You didn't have that outing feeling.
Yeah.
And then they decided it was a lot cheaper, rather than to build all these posts with these things that always got destroyed, to find a way to broadcast the television. Let's start again. Broadcast the movie on your local radio station or on a frequency close to your local radio station.
Yeah.
So in those days now, which is actually it didn't last very long until drive-ins became redundant. You would drive in and park almost anywhere in lines, you know, they had
trying to keep
some form of order, right? And you turn on your radio and tune it until you heard the and it would be just like listening to the radio. For me, somehow it didn't have that same feel, you know. But it was better. It was superior sound
because you control your own sound.
Right.
Quality.
And it was more synchronized with the screen. Not that the detachable speakers were not synchronized. They were until you heard it on the radio and you realized that they weren't. If you get my drift.
You know, technological leap makes you go, oh, it can be better.
Exactly. But that trip to see it's a mad world at the Harbour View Drive-In, fantastic. And I mean, that movie caught my attention. I held it. You're just talking about you and Douglas in the backseat jumping up and down, suffering as all children do from ADD, you know, and not really watching the movie more than off and on. Well, I'm telling you, that movie caught my attention and held it, not from the very beginning, but from this point forward, when the guy who was being chased and who drove off the cliff, and he was gasping his last few words and telling them about all this so-called hidden treasure, and then just as he was finished delivering his spiel, his knee straightened in a reflex and his foot actually kicked a bucket down the hill, and I said, okay then. This guy has kicked the bucket.
Rewatching this movie this week, oddly enough, that kind of connection didn't even come to me. I was just like, oh, his last action was still physical. Like, it wasn't the usual Hollywood death where, you know, everything exaggerated and they're falling down for 20 minutes and the last gasp is literally the last gasp. I was just like, oh, his last action was just his leg jerking.
He kicked the bucket. and I saw it. I said, you know, this movie is going to be brilliant. You know, it's got to be. If that's how it starts at that level, it's got to be brilliant.
There's something that I kind of have to note, and I think this might come from my own like post kind of getting into film. That something that I realized from a time, and you can tell me whether this played in at all to what you were looking for or what you saw, but in the 60s, there was this thing with movies where, mainly because television became such a powerful medium in the world, that filmmakers felt this need to make everything more, make everything grand. And It's a Mad, Mad World was released a year after Lawrence of Arabia, one of the most epic of films that was ever released
Cecil
in history.
Cecil B. DeMille, am I right? Was that Cecil B. DeMille?
No, why can't I remember the name? That it starred Peter O'Toole. It was, he's the same guy who did like River Kwai, I believe, and all of these grand epic films. His name just is escaping me right now.
No, if it's River Kwai, it's not Cecil DeMille.
And I will do what I always do, which is use the internet to help me remember things that I cannot remember because I am just...
Have you ever considered going easy on the magnesium?
David Lean. I don't know why the name just escaped me. It's a Mad, Mad World was released with probably, I believe, the longest runtime a comedy has ever been released from. The 2.5 hour version is what I believe you saw in the theater, theatrical. Yeah.
And that's the thing too. Movies were never that long,
right? Yeah, yeah. And for a 9 to 11 year old to sit through a 2.5 hour movie, which actually has a 3 hour plus full version that the director wanted to release, I'm curious if the actual scale of the film itself played into how you kind of ended up viewing the movie and movies moving forward.
Yes, because that movie, that name you just called,
Lawrence of Arabia,
I never saw it. First thing is, we were too young. Secondly, in those days, even though the fee to enter a movie was not what you would consider a lot, it was a lot for a young family with three children and so on, and so you had to pick, choose and refuse. And movies were, oh gosh, I can't explain it to you, because today's world, there's so much variety of entertainment to choose from. Movies were special. They were treats to go to a movie. So I didn't see many movies. And this one is actually the first one I've seen on that kind of a grand scale. And it really sunk home. I've subsequently seen Lawrence of Arabia, of course, you know. But I mean, at the time, my movies were... And again, all of this has to do with cost. Very important. Ask the great Bill Cosby. Cost. we would go with friends on a Saturday morning down to Regal or Carib, where they would have a triple bill. So you pay once and you see three movies. And it would be like a Tarzan triple bill. All three movies with Johnny Weissmuller on Tarzan. Or a John Wayne triple bill. Or a Kirk Douglas triple bill. You know, and... these were movies that we loved, don't get me wrong, but they were, in retrospect, very simply put together, you know, with I hate to use this word, but almost crude storylines, if you know what I mean, and very little thought went into watching these movies. When I saw that guy kick that bucket, you know, I realized that here was a man who was going to force you to think throughout that movie. And in my whole life, nothing has attracted me more than being forced to think.
So, Aris, I'm curious, before I start to go into what I kind of feel watching the movie from today's perspective and what I see as influence within this movie, I'm curious... did it at all change, not to say that you had much choice at that age, but did it at all change the way, not necessarily that you looked at movies, but the way that you looked forward to what movie you would think you'd like, maybe that's what I might want to watch?
Definitely. And it begins with the same set of movies I was telling you about. I no longer wanted to watch the old-fashioned John Wayne movies. When John Wayne tried to become an actor, you know, in movies like True Grit, and I went back to him. But the old-time movies that I used to watch and get all excited about no longer excited me. You know, I now needed to see a movie that made you think. And it all began with It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. The next one, strangely enough, that strikes me is Iger Sanction. It's a bit of distance of time, but what I'm getting at is the types of movies I wanted to watch changed. I was no longer a cowboy fan. I never became a kung fu fan. Kung fu came after It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. But because of the way my processes were operating, I didn't even want to see it.
Okay.
It was just too crude. You know, just too, there was no thought to it, in my opinion. So I missed the Kung Fu craze.
Mm-hmm.
I looked for these movies with these big casts and these storylines and with the most important ingredient, humor.
Yeah, you definitely are very much a comedy person. Like when I try to peddle movies on you, which you know I do all the while.
Incessantly.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I know that I'm, with my love of film, that while I do enjoy everything in its own right, I do feel that I go more on the serious side most times if I had to, like, take a test of out of 10. You know? But you're always looking for the funny.
always. And it has a lot to do with life, you know. Life up to 1980, 79, around that time, was pretty happy-go-lucky, as it is for all young people. Starting with marriage, and then these unaccustomed appendages. What do you call them again? Children, something like that.
We weren't born by 1980.
No, I'm giving you... when you start going into those things, life becomes so much more of a serious pursuit.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow, going to the movies to watch sad, serious movies doesn't thrill you as much as it used to.
Mm-hmm.
You need something that's not the same as your life, in other words. Which is not to say serious movies don't excite me. It's just that I don't care how long you and I live. You will never get me to watch a movie of 2 hours of a man alone in a coffin with a cell phone.
You're never going to let me live down buried.
No. A man in a coffin with a cell phone. Come on, how did a man get in a coffin with a cell phone? You know, I don't know. I'm too old.
You're too old. So, you talk about It's a Mad, Mad World and its humor as being something that inspires thought.
Right.
Forcing you to kind of deconstruct what's being put in front of you to take out intention more than just simple A to B moments.
Right.
But at the same time, when I watched it, and I know I've seen this before many a times, you've made me watch it, but it's been a very long time since I've seen it. Again, watching it the other day, I could see all of the olden slapstick 30s.
Absolutely. You hit the nail on the
just
head.
Just down, like, Marx Brothers and Chaplin and everyone.
Don't
just
forget the legendary Jerry Lewis.
Doing homages in this film.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, people like to categorize all of that kind of comedy as very lowbrow and very, not unintentional, but thoughtless comedy.
Absolutely.
Where it's very physical and very immediate.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you separate those two kind of worlds within this movie?
Yes, people don't understand slapstick who think it is lowbrow.
Mm-hmm.
Slapstick is... Well, sorry, let me start at the beginning. All comedy is about timing.
Yes.
Eh? Okay. There is no more difficult thing to time than physical comedy. Let's not call it slapstick.
Okay,
right? That physical comedy. When you are doing stand-up and you are delivering your jokes, you're in full control. When you are depending on somebody else to hit you in the face with a pie, it's not so easy to get the timing right, to get the reaction exactly right, because I assure you, the reaction that you see on screen is not the reaction that you would normally have if somebody hit you in the face with a pie. Yeah? It's just harder, and it transmits so many messages in one physical act that sometimes you have to sit down and watch the scene 2, 3, 4 times to see all the messages that are coming out. And as I say, I still insist, I went through the Three Stooges, I went through the Marx Brothers, I went through, who's on first? Abbott and Costello.
Abbott and Costello.
I mean, I've been through all of them. None of them had it pat like the great Jerry Lewis. If you watch those Jerry Lewis movies, and look at them, Andrew, today, people are still remaking them. It has to be something there, you know? People are still remaking them.
No, I agree. The ideas are always there. Yeah. But there is just this idea throughout time that comedy, more than any other type of storytelling or entertainment, is something which ages quickly. Because people's sense of humor has changed. Not so much a sense of humor, but socially, their idea of what's funny changes.
Right.
Right? And more than that, because while people always say every story has its own benefit and the ideas are what keep it going throughout, comedy is based on, like how you were saying, timing and expectation and not knowing what's coming. But because you will spend a generation with a Jerry Lewis, you will come to understand Jerry Lewis. And then when you move to the next generation, that's what you expect, and therefore it doesn't quite hit you as much. So I guess two things kind of come out of that. Number one, how have you felt with the shift of comedy over the years, whether it be in entertainment in general, like doing this is what you were always remembering and what you see today?
I have no problem with today's comedians. Some of them are fantastic. Most of them are good. But I need to make a point. People's idea of what might be funny changes because of their experiences.
Yes.
For example, I don't know. First thing is, by the way, it's a mad. A lot of people say that it is Popeye Doyle. What's the name of that movie? French Connection, right? That the French Connection had the first car chase. Rubbish. It was It's a mad world. People's experiences change. Their ideas of what is funny changes, they think, but it's not true. The fundamentals never change. What changes is how you, what you put on top of those fundamentals. Let's take music. You know, I'm a lover of music.
Yes.
The fundamentals of every music is the drum and bass line.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fundamental of every single musical experience. Bass line. You start with a bass line, and then you drop in your melody on top of that, and your melodies might change. And then if you're doing the ultimate, which is jazz, you have people improvising with solo instruments, and you get a final product. But the bass, the man who is on the drums and the man who is on the bass drives the entire experience.
Yeah.
So it is with comedy. It does not change. The fundamentals do not change. I keep telling people, if you watch the great Jim Carrey closely, if you watch a Jim Carrey movie today, and right after you finish watching that movie, you put on a Jerry Lewis movie, you realize that Jim Carrey is nothing more than Jerry Lewis's bass line with a modern melody.
No, I'm not talking about the idea of because that brings in the idea of evolution,
right?
And that's something that all art needs, right? Because just like how I mentioned with It's a Mad World, I looked at it and I saw the Jerry Lewis's, I saw the Marx Brothers, I saw the Abbott and Costello's, right? But at the same time, they were doing something, they were almost adding on top of it with what you were mentioning, the whole idea of, oh, he kicked the bucket, right? That was a point where you were like, I know I've seen these things before, but something about this just changed it a little bit.
But well, it was the visual too. For example, I know you don't want me to leap to the end of the movie.
No, I don't.
Okay. But for example, the kicking of the bucket is one thing. But if you remember, the guy said the treasure is buried beneath a big W. There is this absolutely superbly directed scene towards the end of the movie, where all the, let's call them contestants, arrive at the park where the treasure is to be buried. And they're all scurrying up and down, looking on the ground for a W, or for a series of bushes.
Something that is a word, W.
Yeah, right. Written, or like maybe some bushes that are shaped like, and they're scurrying up and down and sideways and north and south and east and west. And for the entire scene, in the backdrop, there are four, I call them coconut trees, because I don't know what really to call them. Maybe palm trees, because it's in Florida, right? Yeah. You know? Which who form, high in the sky, a huge W. And the moment when, it's been a long time, but I think it was Phil Silvers who first, was it? Was it Phil?
It was one of the wives who first saw it. But
naturally, it would be a woman, wouldn't it? Yeah, right.
And she was like, we can take it from them. And
yeah. But the moment when the first person, you know, that comic timing, stops. And you can see the brain
looking directly at you. You can see the eyes rolling around going, I saw something.
But where did I see it, you know? This is what I'm saying. There's no oral stuff in that.
Mm-hmm.
It's all visual. And although it wouldn't be what you call fundamental slapstick,
mm-hmm.
it is what I'm talking about. It is it's a drum and bass line of slapstick with a different melody and solo added. But it's visual, it's physical, and it was brilliant.
Like, I think the moment for me that kind of comes across the most in this movie was literally the exact end, which was after the entire caper and just everything goes on. You have this moment with everyone in the hospital, and the police officer who's going to get the worst of the bunch of all of them goes, I don't think I'll ever find anything funny ever again. And he just dropped banana peel. And that's simple, just such a simple and, as you mentioned, fundamental kind of idea of physical comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, everyone just breaks out laughing as if they're asking us, the audience, like, this is how simple we need it to be.
Right. Have you ever seen the great George Carlin?
Yeah.
People think that his comedy is all about words. It's really about pictures.
Mm-hmm.
George Carlin does a bit about, I don't know what to call it, when you have dead skin on your head. Have you ever seen it?
I think I know this one. Yes. I could be wrong.
He does a bit about dead skin on your head. And he speaks for 5 minutes on the subject of dead skin on your scalp. And every time he speaks, you see it. He paints a picture. And you see this fellow trying to get rid of an irritating piece of dead scalp, but trying not to make anybody see what he's doing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And as I keep saying, it's just all up a change of the slapstick. But go back to that end of caper. I'm glad you mentioned that. Here's another thing that I love about this movie, why I say it makes you think. The entire movie, I don't care who you are, I don't care how brilliant you are, don't you get the feeling that the movie is about who is going to get to this money first? What I call the contestants, the Phil Silvers, the Mickey Rooneys, the legendary Jonathan Winters as a truck driver. Oh my God, one of the greatest timing comedians of all time, Jonathan Winters. Ethel Merman doing comedy. You never thought you'd ever see that as long as you live, you know. And yet, after they find the money, that's when you discover what is the real purpose of the movie. It's really all about a policeman who has given his whole life, and that's the great Spencer Tracy, who has given his whole life to the force, is about to be robbed of a decent pension, he's about to retire, and they will not give him a proper pension. And so he has decided that he's going to benefit after all these people. He'll allow all these people to run up and down the place and
do the hard work.
Do the hard work, and then he's going to collect the money.
Mm-hmm.
So the show is really not about the comedian scrambling around to get there first. The show is about Spencer Tracy.
And that's actually one of the most interesting things, because as I think about this story and about the 60s, like, for me, it's hard not to think of all of the ridiculous remakes that we've seen over the years. I think the most recent one that kind of jumps into my mind is Rat Race.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say it was a good movie, but
it was well named.
I had my fun at the time with it. But it's just a difference of how they handle that actual ending, because that idea of a guy who gives his whole life to this job and is, as you say, being robbed of what we hope is a decent pension and a decent end life.
Right.
In Rat Race, they change that completely to take it away from any of that real world depression and thought process to something which is just so silly and whimsical. And they're like, oh, we're just going to have it be everyone didn't really get the money, but no one really, it doesn't really matter in the end for everyone. And it's something that I remember, I think, more and more about of films of that era, where they tried, no matter how silly or how dumb or how immediate the idea of a film was, they tried to put in something that might make the audience think of the world differently.
This is exactly what I'm talking about. You go to the movies, and when you leave the movies, you have learned something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just funny. It's not just action-packed. It's also educational. A 10-year-old or an 11-year-old watching a policeman in the street, that policeman is like an institution.
Mm-hmm.
He's not a person. He's an institution. It never dawns on you that 25-year-old policeman that you just saw on the street is a human being who one day is going to be 65.
Looking a pension.
Yes. Would never enter your head in a gazillion years. And I defy you to find a movie before It's a Mad, 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 Mad World that even introduced that thought about policemen. Or any civil servant, for that matter. The movie was just fun. Like I said, by John Wayne movies, cowboys and Indians, bad guys and good guys, and the good guy always won.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and except for Kirk Douglas, who always died in the end. What a man could die. and with the wheeling and turning and falling and his last words. Brilliant. And for the first time, it dawns on a young boy that there's more to life than just being a youngster, enjoying yourself, you know,
mm-hmm.
making what money you can, earning it, spending it. There's going to come a time when you're going to look like your father, you know.
No, it won't.
other than people coming and telling you look like your father. And you're going to, and you're going to need security.
Mm-hmm.
That's what that movie taught me. It wasn't a movie about a lot of con artists scrambling about, although I loved it. I that's what I thought it was about as I was watching it. You know, trying to see which con artist would get to the money first. It's a movie with a real moral. And the moral to that movie, I went away from it at an early age, was we have to treat people that work for a living better than we do.
And then it even makes you hate the people who want to run around and grab up a little
precisely,
money more.
Precisely. You realize how futile their quest was.
Mm-hmm.
When here was a man with a genuine need, you know. And if you remember, a long time ago, during the movie, while the scrambling was going on, while Jim Backus was being asked to fly a plane, although he was totally drunk, you know, the policeman was desperately trying not to become a criminal.
Mm-hmm.
Up to the very last minute, he was hoping that something would be done for his pension so that he did not have to do this.
Yeah.
You know? But at the end of the movie, the overriding moral also comes in, which is it doesn't matter what your purpose is, crime does not pay.
But then you get to laugh at a banana peel.
So. There you go, yes. Right, there you go.
It's... So, I already kind of talked about movies that you look forward to after this. You already kind of brought in your change of opinion, your change of perspective of this movie as time went on. And this moral, but I'm most curious that with the shift in entertainment, the shift in comedy, I'm kind of curious as to how you view this actual comedy or this style of comedy today. Even if it's not in this movie, if somehow you turn on your cable and you turn on classic movies and you see a Marx Brothers film, do you sit down and start to look at it critically to be like, it feels like we're so far away from that it no longer works?
Again, what I see a little deeper than the... I firmly believe that there's nothing new in this world, right? Ever. So I see a little deeper when I look at Eddie Murphy, and I know I'm still not yet in the modern world, but it kind of started with Eddie Murphy.
I'd actually go so far as to say it started with why can't his name, why is his name escaping me? The guy who wrote Blazing Saddles, he was in Brewster's Millions, and caught himself on fire on crack cocaine, and everyone,
Richard Pryor,
name is just escaped me.
Yes, actually, I think you're right. I think Pryor was even before. I think Pryor inspired Eddie Murphy.
Yeah.
Pryor was different. Pryor was...
It always takes someone
who's just a
different.
Genius, yeah. Pryor was just a genius.
Mm-hmm.
But Pryor was a very troubled human being. And a lot of it came out in his comedy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but he was a genius. And the movies that he made, now with Gene Wilder, mm-hmm. if you remember them.
Silver Streak.
Right. But Eddie Murphy, I'm convinced Bill Cosby was his hero.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he hasn't said so, but I'm convinced of it.
He even has a joke against Cosby, I
remember. That's right, with the cursing.
Quote-unquote against, you know?
Yeah. For me, Bill Cosby is the greatest comedian of all time, mm-hmm. bar none. You know, there's just no comparison. Eddie Murphy tried to be a relevant Bill Cosby in that he thought that the youngsters wanted to hear more. How can I put it? Something that was more appealing to a modern crowd who'd listen to other things and who knew that there were curse words in the world, you know. And so Eddie Murphy took Bill Cosby's humor and made it raw.
Mm-hmm.
But when I saw that, I said to myself, you know, just give him time. And sure enough, I don't know if you noticed, the day after he had his first child, Eddie's comedy toned back right back down. Again, you have your own little way of adding to it, but mm-hmm. the fundamentals remain the same. I insist, I don't see a genuine change in comedy. Now, having said that, there will always be people who are just so brilliant and so unique, is that the right word? That they will not follow the formula I just mentioned. There's Carlin. Right? Now, Carlin, you can't analyze Carlin. Okay? He just insisted on being different. There's the great Robin Williams.
Yeah.
Who is just out of this world. There is... What's the guy? There are people like Whoopi Goldberg, whose career as a career has been disappointing,
mm-hmm.
but she started off as a brilliant
comedian. Can I be
comedian.
Honest? I can barely remember Whoopi Goldberg as people want to think of her.
Uh-huh.
Like, I don't think of her as an innovator. I think of her as a bookmark somewhere. And yes, maybe she had something at the time, but I can't really find it.
Yeah. Trust me, when she started out, she was an innovator.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what happened. Maybe economics, like everybody else, mm-hmm. you know. And she was forced to become, or tried to become, another Oprah. There are people like that. There are few and far between who just fly away from the standard.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, when you look at every single comedian, you can see that they all come from Bob Hope, Bill Cosby, Milton Berle. Milton Berle did a bit spot in It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. Milton Berle. Milton Berle was the king of comedy at that time.
Look, Buster Keaton was a smaller role in this movie.
So yeah, there you go, you know. It was a trendsetter. Hmm? It was a trendsetter. But I don't know. I could be wrong. But when I watch comedy today, the only comedy that I see that has changed is the television sitcom.
Mm-hmm.
But you must remember that the television sitcom is itself a art form that is not of vintage. It hasn't been with us for long.
Yeah.
Relatively speaking,
from like the 70s up.
Exactly, it hasn't been with us for long, and so it is still itself finding its feet.
Mm-hmm.
So you will see that what we used to look at as a comedy, like My Three Sons, a no prize to anybody who can tell me who was the star of My Three Sons.
I'm lost.
Yeah,
I'd go to the internet, yeah? But I'm too lazy. Right.
But by the time you reach the internet, it'll be too late, because I'll have told your listeners that it was a chap called Fred McMurray.
Oh. I know him as the guy I love in The Apartment, or the guy I should hate.
Yeah,
I love The Apartment.
People at McHale's Navy, mm-hmm. in the late 60s. Those again were sitcoms, but they didn't have the genre down.
Mm-hmm.
It was really a half-hour show, mm-hmm. as opposed to a one-hour show.
Yeah.
They didn't really have the situation part of the sitcom down pat.
I think most people kind of always take a bullet towards MASH.
Yeah, yeah.
As being the one.
Yeah, one of the ones. I have a hard time myself, as a comedy lover, setting out my 1, 2, 3 among MASH, The Honeymooners, which is one of the earliest ones, starring the legendary Jackie Gleason, Art Carney, Audra Meadows, and I'm trying to remember who was Art's wife, but her name is slipping me. Eh?
I always only remember Jackie Gleason.
And, of course, The Cosby Show.
Mm-hmm.
MASH, and of course, don't forget the Mary Tyler Moore Show. The sitcom really began with the Mary Tyler Moore Show,
yeah.
in the mid-70s. Mary Tyler Moore was in a sitcom previously called The Dick Van Dyke Show, which was included the great Rob Reiner and, mm-hmm. and that lot. But this the real genre didn't start to feed itself until Mary Tyler Moore, followed by All in the Family. But the problem with the American sitcom, why I say it is only just now beginning to define itself, is that most of those shows Mary Tyler Moore accepted were mere copies of English shows.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't really the American sitcom. The stuff that's on today now, I think, is developing a new American sitcom genre,
mm-hmm.
that we have to wait and see.
As I'm actually stand very up. Excited by how sitcoms... Well, not generally, because, I mean, there are very few sitcoms that I love.
Mm-hmm.
But the ones that I do, I see where something new is happening and something special.
Definitely.
And especially what I like to call, I'm sure many people smarter than me would redefine it. What I like to call is filmmaking bleeding into television. Right? Because... The sitcoms as we remember it from the 70s, well, I shouldn't say we, I'm young, mm. as it is remembered in the 70s, yeah. is a very theatrical thing, where you have a stage and the actors play their parts in a very communal moment. Film has always been a thing where it is intentionally directed, one by one, piece by piece. Mm. And more of the most popular or the most interesting, as I like to call it, sitcoms of today are trying more and more to be like that in film. The people like to use the differential of a single camera versus a multi-camera. And I think the one that I like to point to is always Scrubs, but I think you don't have quite a likening to that show.
Well, to be fair to Scrubs, I don't think I watched it often enough. But it did not catch my eye, let's mm-hmm. put it that way. It was, I again, as an older fellow, the sitcom to me needs to have some reality base to it. You know, a comedy in a hospital, it's a little disturbing to a chap who is closer to the time when he's going to actually need a doctor. You know, yeah. But no doubt about its popularity. No doubt about it.
None whatsoever.
Mm.
Anyways, I think I can call it there. Thank you so much for talking with me, and I hope you enjoyed this as much as I did.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Have a wonderful podcast, and remember me when you direct your first movie. You know, don't forget, although I'm older than you, I'm available for adoption.
Look, I've learned my lesson.
Yeah?
I will point it to Mummy for the first one.
Yes, indeed.
You can get all the other ones.
Okay, fair enough. Hmm?
That was the episode. As usual, I should put all of my plugs right here so you guys hear it. The show, you can find all of it over on gmanreviews.com, as well as my writings and all of my other podcasts, including the Unnamed Movie Podcast. I like how I say all of my podcasts, like I have a billion of them. No, I just have this and the Unnamed Movie Podcast. And until I get another grand idea or decide to do this as a proper business, who knows? Maybe Tump Industries will be the next Nerdist. Do you want to be a part of the next Nerdist, which is Tump Industries? I probably shouldn't use their name because they'll, like, sue me or something. They seem like nice people, they won't. They're probably laughing at me if they ever find out about this. They're like, this guy thinks he's going to be the new Nerdist. He's like, ah, that's cute. Anyways, I'm finding a way to detract from the outro. As I said, over at gmanreviews.com, where you can hear this podcast and others, as well as my writing. I'm on Twitter. I'm at gmanreviews. You can follow my father on Twitter. He's at the Terrible Tout. Go harass him. Go say hi. Say hi, Andrew's dad. You like funny movies. That's good. And stuff like that. That's about it. So thank you so much for listening, and good night. It's a mad
world. I know it may sound jerky, but in Turkey, who eats turkey?
Yes, yes.
Confess, it's a mad
world.
Our traffic is so congested. Mass confusion on wheels.